Hello and welcome to Rapids Fire, the Accelerated Data Science Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Mahler. My guests this week are Zara Ranagi, Engineering Manager of AI Infrastructure at NVIDIA, and Christoph Keller, Atmospheric Chemist at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. We talk about their collaboration to bring GPU-accelerated data science to NASA. We hear about the challenges that they had in that process. They give some words of wisdom for people interested in doing the same thing themselves. We learn about how the impact of COVID-19 on the climate was better understood as a result of GPU acceleration. And we hear a little bit about the future possibilities that GPU-accelerated data science might have for atmospheric and natural science. It's a great episode. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll be back at the end. Thanks. Both of you, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Paul, for having us.
Thanks for having me.
To start off, I'll begin asking you, like I ask all my guests, and we'll start with Zara. How did you end up here today?
Yeah, so I would say my data science career really started during my postdoc at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. I come from an HPC and image processing background. So I joined the lab through the NESAP program, which is NERSC Exascale Science Applications Program. And their goal is really to port existing code to the next hardware and architecture. So a lot of the applications that are running on this HPC cluster, how can we optimize it for the next system at the lab? So through that, I wanted to also get involved with some of the deep learning projects. So looking at some of the other techniques that were coming up that could either improve or replace traditional image processing techniques. I really got involved with a couple of projects there too, really enjoyed all of the projects that I was involved with at the lab. And then after the program, I kind of already had an idea that I wanted to join NVIDIA. I was already a big fan of GPUs, working with them through my research. I continued to work in a similar space, so HPC plus AI. And then I became familiar with Rapids. So the first few months that I was in NVIDIA, I started working with a couple of the engineers on the team, and I thought, this is super exciting. This is an interesting idea that now is enabling a lot of users to use Python and take advantage of GPU acceleration without really having to write CUDA code or, you know, use any of the directive-based programming languages. So that's where I really started getting involved with a couple of the DOE labs and NASA and other folks, and we started collaborating on projects focused on Rapid.
Christoph, tell us about your background and how you ended up here today.
My background is really, I've always been a science nerd, I would say. I've always loved science. So from the, you know, very beginning, even as a little kid. And I've also always loved the outdoors. And so for me, it was sort of like a natural fit to study earth sciences. And that's kind of like what I did. I got a PhD in earth sciences. And then I was lucky enough to have an opportunity to do a postdoc. And I did that. And while I was doing that, I sort of like got connected to the NASA Earth system modeling community. And I started to really develop Earth system models, especially for atmospheric chemistry. So how the composition of the atmosphere changes within the NASA Earth system models. And then after my postdoc, I sort of like transitioned to the NASA side, kept developing the systems. And as I was doing that, I really got interested in sort of like, how can we accelerate some of the simulations? Because the computational cost of those numerical simulations are enormous, and it's really the bottleneck for a lot of the applications. And so that's how I got involved with machine learning and, you know, data science, and then eventually also with using some of the Rapids software in particular to really accelerate my workflow, and it has been a real game changer.
Tell us a little bit about the collaboration that you two worked on. For listeners, the two-part blog that they wrote will be linked in the episode description, and I encourage you to check that out. It looks like there was some real heavy lifting in this project. I was surprised that there's a package to convert Fortran to XGBoost. How did the collaboration come about, and how does this make, like you mentioned, Christoph, the research that you've been working on more useful or more valuable?
I am developing essentially a real-time air quality forecasting system. That's how you can think of it. It's a bit bigger than that because it's not just air quality, but it's really the entire composition of the atmosphere from the surface to the top of the atmosphere. What are all the chemicals and how do they react with each other? And we want to monitor that in real time. And really our main goal is then also to support all of the NASA missions that supplement sort of like that information with NASA observations, whether that's satellite data or it's aircraft observations. So we build essentially the Earth system models around all of those observations. And my part is really on the composition of the atmosphere. As I said, there are hundreds of chemicals in the atmosphere and they all react with each other. So it's a huge dating pool of chemicals, and simulating that essentially in real time is computationally just extremely expensive, especially if we want to do it at the scales, both in time and in space, that we would really like it to do. So we would love to do this on a kilometer scale, maybe even sub-kilometer, but right now, numerically, we just can't do it at that scale. And so we need to look at some other solutions. How can we accelerate this? How can we simplify it to some extent? And that's where sort of like the collaboration then with NVIDIA and Sarah in particular came in. Because at some point I was interested in like, can we use machine learning to do some of those simulations or some of those calculations instead of actually calculating it numerically, which is just very slow. And so I started to build machine learning models using all of that Earth science model output that we have to really see, can we actually develop some emulators? And so that's where I started, and I knew absolutely nothing about machine learning or GPUs. And so coming from like my background in CPUs and traditional numerical modeling, I did everything sort of like on traditional hardware, I would say. And I quickly realized that we just wouldn't get anywhere with that. And so then once I started to actually explore some of the options with GPUs, et cetera, I realized this is a real game changer. I can now really start doing things that I couldn't do before. And in particular, it would just massively accelerate sort of like the development cycle. Now, instead of having to wait for hours or so for a machine learning model to train, I would just like click a button and it was essentially ready to analyze. But of course, there were some technical hurdles for me. And this is where it was just really helpful to have somebody to reach out, have questions answered. And so Sarah was extremely helpful in that. And so kind of like working together, I think we were able to develop a system so that we can now build machine learning workflows and machine learning systems that can essentially simulate how the chemicals react in the atmosphere. We have now gone past that stage of just the proof of concept and are now really implementing this actually into our real models. So the sort of like the exciting part in some ways is still ahead of us, where we start to build these machine learning models into our actual operational system, so to speak. And then we can really, I think it's going to be a game changer for some of the things that we can do with those models, because then we can make better predictions, we can make them faster, and we can make more detailed predictions.
We started working on this project maybe a couple of years ago, you know, sometimes on and off, depending on some other projects that we're working on or, you know, conferences that come up. But I did also want to mention Jim Hooks, who's the business development manager at NVIDIA, and he works with NASA. I think he attended one of Christoph's presentations, and he was mentioning how he's using XGBoost. At the time, RAPIDS was still pretty new. We were working with the XGBoost community to, you know, extend some of these implementations to multiple GPUs too. That's where we really got connected and started working on this collaboration. So we looked at, you know, where can we take advantage of, you know, GPU acceleration, other parts of the code that we can potentially port to GPUs, and some of the new features that we were adding to XGBoost, you know, how to train these models on a single node with multiple GPUs and also be able to scale out to multiple nodes and multiple GPUs.
I have a couple of questions. The first will be, what was the biggest challenge in porting your workload over to like a more Pythonic environment? A sub question to that is, I was at Dask Summit a couple of weeks ago, and there was another climatologist there that was also talking about Fortran. So I guess my first question is, why so much Fortran? For people that might not be aware that a legacy language like that is still doing so much heavy lifting. And then what were the biggest challenges for this project in terms of getting that code onto Rapids?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you know, if you had asked me one of the biggest challenges in this entire project, it's exactly about this sort of like the interplay between our traditional systems, which are still high performance computing on a Fortran system, versus sort of like the machine learning and GPUs, and most of it really is now based in Python. The reason why everything is still in Fortran, it's twofold. First of all, this is like millions of lines of legacy code, and rewriting everything will be quite the undertaking. And then the second piece is like, show me something that's faster. Like Fortran is still extremely fast for all of those calculations that we want to do. And just to give you an idea right now, so we have a real-time composition forecasting system that we run every day. And just to make a five-day prediction, it still takes us 8 hours on sort of like thousands of CPUs and using Fortran. So any kind of like penalty that we will get by switching it to, let's say, Python or so, where you have more overhead, it's just not feasible for us. The biggest challenges in terms of like making it work with Python, for us, one of the biggest challenge was that all of our output is in netcdf data format, and that's not something that works naturally, at least historically, with something like XGBoost. And I know that there is now some work to make sort of like those data formats integrate more easily with Rapids. And for us, that will be a big game changer. And then the other step is kind of like going the other way around. Once you have your machine learning model, how you can actually deploy that within an HPC system. And so that's where we then developed essentially our own little Fortran code that could call the XGBoost emulator that we developed. That was initially also a quite a big task. It was just something that I didn't expect initially when I started, but we ended up spending maybe half of our time overall in just developing essentially that interface so that we can actually deploy the machine learning model within our actual Earth system model. That was a little bit of a heavy lifting, but I also know that there are now more and more people actually developing those tools so that you can run even like something like TensorFlow or so from within a Fortran-based system. As those tools are now being developed, that makes it more and more adaptable also to other users. And obviously, we have now the interface for XGBoost. We can now call it straight away.
Some of the initial challenges when we got started, the work of XGBoost with Rapids, we're still in the early stages. One thing that I can remember is that we didn't have a way to really read our data into the D-matrix format used by XGBoost. But at the state that it is right now, you know, you can just directly load your data from cuDF. So a couple of things that we worked on, I think, initially together, and we go back and, you know, try to optimize it. For example, now we use Rapids Memory Manager in XGBoost 2 that decrease the amount of GPU memory that's used for training these models on the GPU and Dask. So using Dask with XGBoost 2. So these are, I think, some of the things that we initially started with. We were still able to, you know, train our models on the GPU, but I would say, you know, the code is in a better state today, you know, much easier to use. And then maybe just like a few weeks of initially trying to move everything to the system at NASA. So installing Rapids.
Luckily now you can just push it directly to XGBoost. If you're doing deep learning, you can also just push it to DLPAC. Emulators versus numerical solutions. Were these like, these were precise numerical solutions of differential equations that you're now estimating with XGBoost? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, so that's correct. So if we go back again to sort of like the atmospheric chemistry, there's like hundreds of chemicals and they all react with each other all the time. And so we have these numerical equations. And those are a set of differential equations. And you have to solve that essentially every time step that you want to advance the model. And so you repeat that calculation over and over and over again. And it's computationally extremely expensive. And for me, it was always like a question, is there a way that we can approximate this with something like a machine learning model? And so that's kind of like what we set out to figure out. And now we know that the answer for this is yes, we can do it. So there's now a lot of work going on in that field. And really, for me, the main hope here is not that we replace the full numerical model all of the times, but for some of the applications. And so the way that I look at this is our flagship model with the full numerical solution is kind of like our aircraft carrier. And then we have the speedboat applications where we use machine learning if we want to do some forecasts, or if we want to do, well, what if actually the emissions of this power plant were 5 times higher? What would the air quality look like? So we can now answer all of these really exciting questions because we have a way to get answers very quickly and also very localized. So this is, I think, where the machine learning emulators play a really, really important role in the future.
Were either of you surprised by how well XGBoost performs relative to doing the precise numerical solutions?
So it's kind of like a two-folded answer where I did expect it to work, but then how well it actually worked, that was surprising to me.
Did you find that you had pushback about using this more widely, that people were uncomfortable with an estimation versus a precise solution, or were people able to see your results and see them as a step forward, or like you said, like a speedboat approach for particular applications that you weren't able to do before?
So it's not really a replacement of the existing solution, I would say, but it's really an extension so that we can now answer questions that we couldn't before. And so I think once you phrase it that way, it makes it much easier for people to also really see the value of it. And it's not like, oh, we're going to replace the 50 years or so of, you know, development into solving the atmospheric chemistry numerically, but rather we add a tool to the toolbox so that it can give us some solutions when it's acceptable to not have the perfect accuracy. And then the other thing that we haven't really touched upon right now is that there is an issue that the machine learning solutions, they can become numerically unstable if you run them over a very long period of time. And we did see that eventually if we ran the machine learning model over 10 days or 15 days or so, it could become unstable. And so that's another reason why we would never want to run it sort of like in our main application, but we can really use it for some other applications where we have shorter time scales, but it's not really an issue over, you know, a period of days. It's more if we run it for weeks.
If somebody is listening to this, sitting somewhere where they're working with a lot of legacy code like this, what is a good way? Because in a lot of places, you can't necessarily just jump in and do something like this. You need to take baby steps towards it. What is a good way to begin taking those steps?
It really depends on each field of research. Where we've been able to help with, and I've worked with a couple of the DOE labs on similar problems too, is, you know, help them accelerate some of their existing data science workflows. So, you know, they're running this maybe on the CPUs today. They want to be able to train these models faster or process their data much faster. And so we come in and try to really help them port parts of the code to GPU. What we really start with is, you know, really usually a smaller portion of that. So let's say, you know, for Christoph's projects, first training that model on the GPUs, then scaling that out maybe on multiple GPUs, then multiple nodes, and then looking at the rest of the workflow too, you know, looking at the pre-processing pipeline or, you know, the model explainability side of things, and kind of like slowly moving into that side. Now, kind of, you know, working with different research projects and how we can introduce machine learning, I want to say my background is mostly on the image processing side. So I've been doing that maybe in that field a little bit, you know, some of the newer deep learning techniques that we're using for some of this processing, like registration or segmentation, or, you know, reconstruction. And we're able to do this, you know, with higher accuracy and much faster now compared to traditional image processing. Now, it takes time depending on who's using these techniques. If you're looking in the field of, you know, medicine, it's takes a little bit longer to be able to, you know, kind of convince the physicians that are using these techniques compared to maybe like a research lab that they're open to looking at some of these solutions. On the climate and weather science, I'll defer that to Christoph.
My advice and from my perspective, kind of like the best way to start is to start small. just come up with kind of like a relatively small, simple data set. So as Sarah said, you can actually work out the workflow and then you can start just training it and then scaling that up is relatively simple. So for example, in our case, usually we run our model that our flagship model is run at 25 by 25 kilometers squared globally. And so that already produces quite a bit of data. So then for sort of like the test emulator, I actually ran the model at a much coarser resolution. So, you know, 2 by 2.5 degrees or 200 by 200 kilometers square. And then that output was now manageable. And then I could actually build my machine learning workflow with that, go through all of the problems, and then kind of like have, you know, Sarah help me and all the things that didn't work. And then once that workflow was ready, you could say, okay, now let's scale it up and now let's throw more GPUs at it and all of those things, and then really get sort of like the exciting stuff out. But start small and then also maybe find, you know, the one person that is really, really interested in this. If you have a person like that who really loves doing it and then give them the small, you know, problem, then you can usually make progress rather quickly. And then the other thing that I would say, and that's sort of like related, is it also helps you maybe kill some of the projects that just don't work. I think we have to be realistic. There are just certain things that may not work or it may not be worth it. And so if you start small, then you can also identify what's really worth pursuing and where you may just waste your time, so to speak.
Yeah, I want to add to that. I think that was an interesting point that Christoph brought up. And that's super important in some of these collaborations that we've been working on too, is maybe we'll look at a project and say, oh, this is a place that we know, you know, they can take advantage of RAPIDS or GPU acceleration or machine learning. I really want to say one of the reasons that I think this project has been successful and we can continue to work on this together is, you know, Christoph was already excited about this. You know, when we introduced RAPIDS, he said, okay, this sounds interesting. What can we do? I think that really, really helps, you know, finding the people that want to try new, you know, techniques and newer frameworks and models to look into.
Turning to the second part of your blog and everybody's favorite subject, COVID-19, could you tell us a little bit about if and how doing RAPIDS and XGBoost made this project more tractable and also the findings in general? I think that'll be interesting to the listeners. I mean, we all saw pictures of skylines with less pollution, but I know at least for me, I didn't consume any like real science about what was going on. So I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah, sure. The moment that sort of like the world shut down, it was clear to essentially everybody who studies air quality is that this would have a huge impact on air pollution. Nobody really knew how much it would actually matter. And the reason is because, you know, air pollution, it's a very complicated process. It depends on a lot of factors. One of them are the emissions and like how many cars are driving around. But then you also have factories, of course, and then you have the weather that impacts in how those pollutants are transported, how they are trapped at the surface. And then you also have just other processes like the chemistry. And so it's an entire complicated mix. So nobody was surprised when the concentrations essentially went down immediately after the lockdowns. That was pretty much expected. But it was still sort of like difficult to see, okay, how much of that is actually because of people not driving, and how much is it because maybe the weather was unusual? And actually, that's something that sometimes we forget. But last spring, so in spring 2020, the weather was very unusual in a lot of places. It was quite an unusual year weather-wise. And so there were sort of like all of these confounding factors. And so what we wanted to figure out is, can we actually tease out or separate the impact of the lockdowns on air pollution by using our model to essentially simulate a business as usual scenario. So where we stick into our model, just like these are the emissions that we know that they would normally occur. And then we run the model forward. And then that gives us essentially a modeled air pollution value under a business as usual scenario. So if there had been no lockdown, and then we compare that against the actual observation. So this is now a different application. It's not an emulator, but it's really a kind of like a data science project. You know, I started to look at 5,000 sites. All of those have like hundreds of thousands of observations because they measure it hourly. And then you compare that against your terabytes of model output. And so you quickly have like a pretty big amount of data that you want to kind of like crunch and build machine learning models. And again, this is where RAPIDS was just perfect for. And so kind of like pushing this all into that infrastructure enabled me to essentially monitor that in real time, which is really cool, because then I could essentially see whenever every week I kind of like updated it by collecting all of the surface observations and just running the updated numbers. And I could sort of really track kind of like how essentially the air pollution deviated all over the world from what we would expect. And that kind of matched actually sort of like the lockdowns. So it started over China. And then, you know, in China, the sort of like the restrictions were lifted and the pollution levels then went back to normal, so to speak. But then Europe had the lockdown and there the emissions plunged at 40-50% below what we would expect. And then it started sort of like in the US and it never got as crazy as it did in Europe. But it's sort of like all of it, and we could sort of like monitor that in real time. So it was actually kind of cool to do that. And it felt that you know, what we did really made sense also from what you actually saw in the real world, which was nice too. So again, it was sort of like a quick verification loop that, yes, what we get out of sort of like our machine learning models does actually make a lot of sense. And it gives us a quantitative estimate in kind of like what the impact was of the lockdowns on air pollution all over the world.
How was working with SHAP? How satisfactory do you find these estimated impact values versus something that, you know, is maybe more digestible? I don't know if I would say it's more valid, but like recoverable parameters in traditional time series model.
Christoph mentioned we were using XGBoost to train a lot of these models. And we, if we could analyze, you know, the different features and factors that contribute most to this model bias, this could be really valuable. And, you know, you can kind of look at a chart of all the different factors that were involved in training this model, but then you can kind of look at the ones that maybe had the most impact and then go from there. And kind of like the way that now we can explain these models and how we train them and how any of these features played an impact to give us, you know, the final accuracy, or, you know, how we're analyzing some of these models or predicting, you know, future outcomes. I think that's highly valuable. One thing is, though, that I think we were also excited to use the new GPU accelerated tree shab that RAPIDS has been working on. That has also been added into XGBoost. So we were able to, you know, port this part of the code also to GPUs. And again, you know, similar to a lot of the rest of the workflow, you can still stay within the same library, the same code base. This is just one parameter that you can change and be able to now take advantage of even SHAP on the GPUs.
Now, being able to actually write out the SHAP values for me is extremely valuable. I've always felt that with XGBoost, it was nice that you did have some explainability. So you could look at the feature importance and things like that. But I never really felt fully comfortable with it because I felt like it gave a little bit of a distorted view, especially it didn't sort of like look at the dependencies between the features. And now the SHAP values, I feel a bit more comfortable with it. So for me, one of the really exciting pieces about looking at the SHAP values is that you kind of like get a little bit of a sense of what the model does. So you can look a little bit under the hood. And it does give me actually a lot of confidence because the SHAP values that kind of like bubble to the top are the ones that I would expect. So it's things like the boundary layer height or something like that. And I know that this is a really important factor, and that's probably relatively uncertain now in our model. So the fact that the machine learning models do actually pick up the features that I would expect to be important gives me a lot more confidence in our results. So for me, that's actually a very important aspect. And it has also helped me really communicate the results within our community and kind of like convince the people that this is not just black magic, but that there is actually something to it.
What can we look forward to next from the collaboration between you two?
I would say kind of extending this work and now looking at, you know, larger data sets that Christoph and his team have been working with. I think initially I mentioned that was one of the goals too, to be able to really scale out some of these XGBoost models to multiple nodes and potentially even on the HPC cluster that NASA is using to train these models or for some of these simulations. So I think that's one part that I would really like to continue, you know, working on to be able to train these larger models now and look at, you know, where are some of the bottlenecks as we really scale these out, where is our limit, basically. I think that's one place that we'd like to continue working on and then figure out where else we can apply some of these models. After the first initial collaboration that we had, I reached out to Christoph and said, are you interested to now write the result of that into a blog and kind of like publish this? And he mentioned, yes. And I've also actually been using XGBoost now on the GPUs for another project. So it's always exciting to hear about, you know, what else can come out of some of this work that we initially started on.
Yeah, I fully agree. You know, for the first project, the emulator project, I'm very excited because we have now a person who just started, and that's going to be his full-time job is to really push this forward. And so there we're going to, you know, we're really now going to throw a big amount of data at this problem. We want to train a large model and we want to see, so like, how far can we push this? We're now at the stage where we want to deploy this at the large scale and we want to put this really into sort of like our models in a way that we can make some better decisions or some the better information that we can give, provide to the public or to some of the NASA observations that we support. So that's the first part. And then the second piece is the one where I really realized last year as I was working on this COVID project, it's just how much potential there is to analyze the data in real time by combining it with some other data sources. And so I think there's an enormous potential here by using something like, you know, RAPIDS to really kind of like use all of those different data sets to detect anomalies and to really make some sense of what is happening. And then also kind of like condense that and give the information to the outer world in a maybe a simpler fashion and not just like, this is the concentration, but this is the concentration and this is what we would have expected. And so there is something unusual happening right now, right here. And so that type of information, and I think we can do much more in that field. And that's something that I would like to pursue further there.
Yeah. And one other thing that I'll add to this is maybe not specific to this project, but I think out of this, you know, collaboration and some of the work that we've done, we've been able to also present this at some of the workshops at, you know, NASA Goddard and Ames, and now planning to take this to NASA Langley too. So kind of like getting others also involved, those that can, you know, take advantage of the GPU acceleration too. I think talking about this use case, you know, it really helps because we'll be able to talk to the same community that might be looking at similar problems. So I think that has definitely helped into training more users at NASA that are interested in using RAPIDS.
No, that's great. I love to hear when, in some sense, you're getting more with the same amount in terms of, like Christoph suggested, being able to immediately say, something is weird here in a way that you might not be able to if you were still dealing with the kind of like bottlenecks and the slowness of just making so many calculations. I remember that I think the father of weather forecasting like proved that you could do it, but at the time when he was doing it with like pen and paper, it took him like 8 days to forecast one day of weather, which is why we didn't really have weather forecasts until computers got better. Are there other techniques that you're thinking about looking at?
I am thinking about sort of like, we have some other problems, you know, like bottlenecks numerically that I'm wondering is like, well, maybe we could actually emulate those as well. And I'm actually thinking, can we interpret some of our model output as images? And the answer, of course, is yes, we can. And then can we use some of the image machine learning or deep learning solutions and that we can sort of like apply to those. And so that's one of the directions that we are thinking a bit more seriously, especially for something like the transport. So like how do the species kind of like blow around in the atmosphere? That's also computationally quite expensive, especially once you have 200 chemicals or so, all of them blow around. So can we maybe build some deep learning models that can approximate sort of like the transport of those chemicals. And there I'm mostly thinking now about sort of like image to image translation, things like that. And so there's just so much work that has been going on there that I think this is a really big pool that we may be able to dive into and then also get some solutions out there.
To both of you, is there anything that you wish I would have asked that I didn't?
I'm just looking forward to, you know, continuing this collaboration and looking at what we can do, and then potentially that we can, you know, see the results and outcome of some of the work that we've been doing.
Maybe the reason why I actually used XGBoost, and it's a bit embarrassing, I have to say, but it's a project. So me and my buddy, his name is Matt Evans, and he's a professor at the University of York in the UK. But we had sort of like this idea, hey, can you do machine learning for atmospheric chemistry? And we're still like, let's try. And so I knew nothing about machine learning. I said, like, I'm going to try neural network because that's all I know about machine learning. He knew even less. So he just Googled machine learning. And the first thing was random forest. And so he used a random forest and I used a neural network. And then his results were way better than mine. And so we actually were, okay, let's use random forest. And then from there, sort of like random forest to XGBoost is a pretty small step. So that's kind of like why we settled. And now that I know more, I still think I now understand why the neural network didn't work that I had initially and some of the really stupid mistakes that I made and how I normalized things, etc. But that's kind of like how we ended up with. And, you know, maybe that's also a lesson is, I think we were not afraid of just trying something and then it kind of worked. And maybe it's just because we were dumb luck or whatever. But, you know, sometimes you just have to try and it really worked. And it's been an amazing ride.
Yeah, I remember that actually. I think looking at your first presentation and paper on this, you did mention random forest too. And we didn't have the GPU accelerated version of random forest yet. So when you said, now I'm thinking about, you know, using XGBoost, we're like, yes, let's just go with this. This is great. And so we got super excited too. But yeah, now that you mentioned it, I remember that.
Don't be afraid to try, I think is a great note to end on. I thank you both very much for your time. And I look forward to seeing what comes next from this.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Big thanks again to Zara and Christoph. I think that was a great conversation. I'm really excited to see what they do next. I also want to ask something of you, the listener. If there's something that you want to hear about, something exciting going on in data science that you think that we should cover, if you have any feedback, I would love to hear it either on Twitter at RapidsAI or on my personal Twitter at RealPaulMahler. If you like the podcast, you can help us out by writing a review and subscribing to it. I hope you've been enjoying it. And I will talk to you next time. Thanks.